Mr. Adamson, Reel 5. You were talking about the Canadian plane that was shot down in Ura. Was there been an inquiry, presumably, on that?
Oh, yes. There was an inquiry, and I think ACAC command personnel that were involved in the incident were exonerated from any blame, and it was unfortunate that the communication between the aircraft itself and any ground control was non-existent because of damage that had been done to the aircraft during its raid over Germany and his return to England. It was rather sad, and I don't think it provoked any animosity between the squadron that was involved in that and the fact that one of their planes had been shut down by their friends, in other words. I think they had a lot of respect for us, and we had a lot more respect for them.
Did you have many training situations? Was that a
regular exercises? Oh yes, yes, quite often. As and when ACAC command defined that an exercise should take place, it was clearly defined, and everybody involved, from searchlight sites through to anti-aircraft gun sites and things like that, all took place, and it was, you know, properly coordinated, so that any emergencies could be dealt with.
How often did officers visit your side? I think an NCO actually was in charge of a particular side, wasn't he?
On some occasions, it depended on the size of the site itself. If there were a number of sites not directly under control of HQ itself, there would be a number of sites under the jurisdiction of an officer. And the largest of those sites would be the house. Would be the site that housed that officer. So, quite often you could have a lieutenant and a second lieutenant on the site that were responsible for those sites under their jurisdiction. So, yes, we had officers on the sites. In some cases, you didn't.
What would they do if they visited? What would they be looking for?
Just to make sure that everybody towed the line and the site was up to scratch, the cleanliness of the site, the appearance of the people on the site, the other ranks, and to make sure that all orders which had been sent from HQ to the various site HQs were carried out.
And you kept your equipment, boots, everything clean in the usual manner.
Yes.
That must have been difficult on a rural site, you might say.
Oh,
in the
fields. Yes, it quite often could have been a bit of an arduous task. But you had to do it. There were officers there to issue the orders, and we had to obey them. And the NCOs had their task to make sure that the orders that had been issued had been carried out to the express wishes of the officers.
You mentioned that you had one or two moves. That you were at Hutton Gate, or that area. Then you mentioned Redcar and Scarborough. Were they moved quickly after the war started, or what kind of time scale are we looking at?
Well, we started off originally, after war was declared, we started off with the HQ. Was originally in regimental HQ, was at the Armoury in Avenue Road in Hartlepool. But then when the Hutton Gate, what was known in those days, the Hutton Gate Militia Camp was completed, we in fact moved through there, and that became the HQ. So most of the sites were coordinated from there. And the Hutton Gate area, I think we stretched from the outskirts of Billingham to sites up to around the Loftus, Redcar, Loftus, Skinny Grove, and that sort of an area, Redcar, Middlesbrough, the outskirts of Middlesbrough. But then later on we moved from there, and the whole company moved to, with Company HQ being based at Scarborough. We covered in as far back as Whitby and as far as the other side as Pickering, Filey, and places like that. So there was a wide area from the Scarborough command area.
Do you recall the date that move was made?
I would imagine it would be somewhere in the early middle 1940s. You were asking about detection of aircraft, how you separated one from the other. I can relate an incident. We were stationed just outside of Whitby, on the approach road coming in over the moors. And as you approach Whitby, there was a roundabout, and it was known as the Mayfield Road roundabout. It was just as you approach Whitby with the one road turning to your left into what they call Whitby West Cliff, the other road straight ahead going down into Whitby Town itself. And the road to the right, to a very small picturesque village called Russop. And we were on the site this particular day, and as I say, the sound recording equipment in those days, we didn't know any better, but it was rather primitive. It consisted of a set of earphones and four boxes of wood mounted on a parallel bar which revolved round and round, and also elevated up or down to pick up the best sound. But on this particular day, I think we were just more or less cleaning all the equipment, but one of the operators decided to look or listen to what he could hear, and he picked up the sound. And we suddenly saw an aircraft coming in over the Whitby Harbour area. And as it came in, I well remember the remarks, when one of the operators on the side made a remark, "Oh, look, he's dropping a ladder." It was a ladder. It was a stick of bombs. And he bombed a cinema area in Whitby. Now, I actually saw those coming down, and at 17 or 18 year old as I was then, it was a rather frightening effect when I suddenly hear the reports of the bombs going off. But that's just slightly digressing from the main story.
The first place that you're in, talking about the outskirts of Billingham, that was a pretty important area, as you've got your steel works and all kinds of works in that area, hadn't you?
Oh, yes. We had sites all around the area.
Were there many enemy attempts to bomb it whilst you were there?
Not a great deal. I think we were fairly well protected, both with anti-aircraft and also aircraft patrolling up and down in the form of coastal command aircraft.
So who were you working closely with there? Obviously the searchlight battery was there for lighting up enemy aircraft. Was airfields or anti-aircraft gun emplacements? Who were you working with?
Well, they were all coordinated together. But we also, in those days, and quite often if you were in a strategic position, you were in constant touch, not necessarily individually, but there was a constant connection between the Royal Air Force. In those days, when aircraft were going out and coming in over the sea, one position in particular I can remember quite vividly was just outside of Whitby, and we were in a rather high, prominent position, and we could see the convoys, the ships, going up and down the course, and also the destroyers that were actually guarding those convoys. But because of the situation with aircraft, be it enemy aircraft or British aircraft, they used to have coordinated signals so that we knew what the letter and the colour of the day was at that particular time. And this changed every day, and it changed at a certain time. So the letter changed and the colour changed. And the letter was signalled by what was known as a downward recognition light on the aircraft. And the colour of the day would be a combination of any two colours which we knew, because in those days the letter and the colour changed, say, three times a day. But quite often that information also had to be in the hands of the Navy, because convoys going up and down the course could have been subjected to bombing exercises. And in fact, one particular instance, an aircraft was going over a convoy just outside of Whitby, and the next thing, one of the destroyers started pumping shells at it. And the reason being was it was rather unfortunate. He dropped the letter of the day and the colour of the day, but unfortunately it was on a changeover period, and he dropped the letter for the preceding period instead of the one that should have been dropped at that particular time. However, the incident was resolved without any mishap. The correct letters and the correct colours were signalled, and any fire from the destroyers ceased. But there was a combination now with the Navy being involved, the Air Force being involved, and ACAC Command being involved. So it was a coordination between all three services.
What was the communication link between site, battery, and general headquarters?
In the early days, it used to be a radio telephone, an old windy-up telephone. It used to have, at the end of the hut where the telephone was, there was an aerial, something reminiscent of the very early days of television aerials, with a T-shaped aerial on the top of a post about 20 foot high, and you used to be in touch with that. But then as things developed, you eventually got failed telephones and things like that, which were your means of communication. But the early days, it was radio telephone.
There were just a small number of men on isolated sites. Obviously, you're busy during most of the time, but there would be long periods when you weren't. How did you get on as a group? Didn't you get on each other's nerves occasionally?
I suppose that was inevitable. People would eventually take a dislike to him or him or him. But generally speaking, you were all on the same side together. And no matter what you were, whether you were an NCO, whether you were another rank or what, you had to get on with your colleagues. So we just generally did that.
Do you recall any of the people that you were with in these early days?
Oh, yes. Most of them were people of my own age that were Hartlepool born and bred. And, of course, a lot of them in those cases were people that, in my early days as a territorial, I'd drilled with, I'd gone to camp with. So we became pretty close friends. And although there are not a great deal of them left at the moment, I think a lot of them have passed away, unfortunately. Yes, we became good friends, and those friendships lasted a lot of years.
And the officers, I know you've named a number in earlier tapes, that they were good men. You got on well with them, and they treated you properly.
Generally speaking, yes. Generally speaking.
Any stand out that were awkward?
One in particular, an officer belonged to a family in the town. I think they were the Morell Shipping Company. And unfortunately, Peter Morell, he was a lieutenant, Peter Morell and I had a couple of unfortunate run-ins, purely my fault. And Peter and I never got on very, very well together. And eventually, when I did leave the company and join another regiment, I was rather pleased, actually.
What was he, a fisher sort of?
He was doing his duty and I was shirking my duty. That's basically what it was. As a young lad of 18 year old, I was, because I'd been brought up from about 5 to 6 year old and left to a lot of my own devices, I'm afraid that started to take shape when I was in the army, where I was doing things I wasn't supposed to do. And of course I got punished for it.
As the war went on, presumably things improved. You moved from tents to huts anyway.
Yes.
What about the searchlight and its equipment? Did they improve in the first
oh
year or so?
Oh, yes, yes.
What was coming in?
The searchlights became motorised. The original searchlights were on four Caterpillar tractor type wheels. And they had to be hauled about from site to site and placed on wherever they were decided to locate them. But later on, with the advent of radar coming in, which took away all of the old sound recording equipment, radar took its place. The searchlights were much larger. I forget the actual size of the first ones, but I would say they were roughly about 3 foot across the back of the searchlight and the convector mirror. Those that we got later on were on a motorised, well, they weren't motorised, but they were on a chassis, a four-wheel chassis, which housed the radar equipment and also had a tow bar which was towed away from sight, so there was no manually tugging and pulling and pushing things. They had seats for the radar operators to sit on. They had a seat for the searchlight operator to sit on and control his equipment. But yes, the improvement all round on searchlights was tremendous.
And more accurate, presumably.
Oh, definitely. Enemy aircraft used to be, they used to have a cathode ray tube. There were two operators actually operated the elevation and the rotation of the equipment. And another operator actually coordinated the reports from those two. And enemy aircraft or aircraft was shown up on a cathode ray tube, and one was identified quite distinctly from the other, enemy from a British plane. So they were distinguishable. It was no longer a case of listening to two different drones of aircraft engines. You could see it on the screen. It used to give out in those days, if I'm not mistaken, what was known as an IFF signal. And that was an identification of friend or foe. And this IFF signal used to show itself distinctly on the screen as it was moving along the time base on the cathode ray tube. The signal used to have a blip in it, and the blip was an identification. It was something within the wireless situation of the aircraft itself that it transferred to those on the ground, the fact that it was a British plane or a friendly plane.
This would need, you'd need to be trained to this new equipment. Were you going on courses?
Yes, quite often when the new equipment was taken away, you were taken away for a week at a time and given all aspects of the new equipment and trained on it. And of course, as I was, as a searchlight operator itself, as the tradesman responsible for the interior of the equipment, the larger the equipment was a little bit more work, but it was also a lot more interesting. And with radar being part of the sound equipment on the site, we also had an additional staff on the site in the form of radio mechanics, and their job was the equipment that controlled the radar. And quite often our own duties as a searchlight operator actually linked up with the radio mechanics, and we became very friendly. They were of a different regiment. In the early days, they belonged to the Royal Army Ordnance Corps, but they lived on the site and did exactly the same, except for duties, obviously. They didn't have to do guard duties or anything like that. Their responsibility was the radar equipment. But they lived, ate, drank, became very, very friendly with the people on the site.
What period of time would be when these changes started coming in, these improvements?
I think that would be towards the latter end of 1940, early 41, when all those changes started to take place.
Was there great rivalry between sites? Did you try to outdo each other?
Not particularly. I think if the... if there was any rivalry, it would be in the appearance of the site, the cleanliness of the site, and the appearance to any visiting officers, whether it be the company commander or whether it be any of anybody any higher up. Because periodically you used to get people from brigade coming around and obviously examining the sites. I remember on one particular site that we were on, this site had, the approach to the site had been marked out down, was almost like a cart track, but it had been marked out with a number of curbstones. And to make the site look a bit more attractive, they decided to whitewash all the stones all the way down. And unfortunately, one of the brigade commanders has been up with an air observation aircraft. And when he came down to visit that site, the NCO, the officers in charge, actually got a rollicking because the site was so easy detectable from the sky. It was almost like, this is the way, just come and find us. And needless to say, those stones were painted a completely different colour after that.
You started the war, wasn't it? Was Royal Engineers, were you, in the early days?
No, we were the 2nd 5th Battalion, the Dedham Light Infantry.
You still had your Bruegel badge?
We kept our badge until much later. The only distinguishing feature in those days, you had a DLI cap badge, but you had a blue and red flash on your shoulder. You had the anti-aircraft command. We were part of, in those days, we were part of the 7th ACAC command. And our sign was the scales. The scales sign.
And that was a distinguishing...
Yes, I think the scale sign was something to do with the seventh sign of Zodiac. And it was the scales... Now, that was your shoulder flash shoulder badge. And then above that was two small strips of blue and red, which was the artillery colours. But you also kept your Royal... your DLI cap badge. Although that changed much later, and we had to all wear an artillery cap badge.
So how long were you with the searchlights?
About 3 years.
And is there, are there any incidents outstanding in that 3 year period that we haven't discussed?
Well, when the 750 LI decided to change over to light anti aircraft, and I decided because I was a tradesman, albeit only a Class D tradesman, which was the lowest of the trades rank you could get. I think I used to get sixpence a day extra for being a tradesman. That was 3 and 6 a week, and that was a lot of money in those days. So rather than forfeit that and go with the regiment when it went to light aircraft, I decided to stop with the anti-aircraft command. And the regiment that took over our duties was the Northumberland Fusiliers. Now, I don't know what they belong to. I don't know whether it'd be the 54th or what. But nevertheless, I stuck with the Northumberland Fusiliers, and they occupied the area which had been occupied by the 250 LI.
And the equipment, did it stay the same?
Oh, yes, the equipment stopped because the DLI then went on to both, I think it was both guns they went on to, but they left and I stayed, and we reoccupied Hutton Gate Camp as a headquarters once again.
And these would be a change of faces for you?
Oh, yes. A lot of the friends I had decided to go on to both guns and to land in the aircraft. But those that were similar to me stopped with the Surfside Battalions.
And how did you get on with these new people?
Oh, very well. Very well. I made some really excellent friends. Most of them, the regiment, the company I joined, the regiment that they belonged to, the company that I joined was the part of the 2nd, 5th Northumberland Fusiliers Regiment. And they, in fact, were a company that I was with, was what was known as the Walker Company. And most of the people in that company were actually employed in the Walker Naval Yard. And, of course, being an apprentice in an engineering shipyard myself, we had quite a lot in common.
And this, again, the officers and NCOs were changed.
Oh, yes.
Were they okay?
I don't think of all the officers and the NCOs in the regiment when I joined, when I eventually went with the number, I don't think there was any that I can single out and turn round and say there were, what shall I say, there weren't any bad feelings amongst them. As far as I was concerned, it was the best move I made. I got on exceptionally well with all the officers, I got on exceptionally well with all the NCOs, and of course the Geordie lads themselves were real pals.
Who was commanding?
The company commander was a gentleman named, an officer named Major Harvey, and he was a DFC out the First World War, and he was a real gentleman.